This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, exploring pressing public management issues facing us today. I'm Michael Keegan, your host. In this issue of the Business of Government magazine, we survey the intersection where leadership, complex challenges, and the need for transformation meet. Whether it's in the response to the global financial crisis, the national debt, or the myriad of other pressing issues facing us, uncertainty seems boundless, while constraints on resources are very real. It is within this context that we've assembled a varied group of government executives and thought leaders who are focusing on these problems and working to mitigate their effects. They offer their insights, lessons learned, and recommendations on these topics. It's about connecting research to practice, crafting smart approaches that tame immediate demands without losing sight of the iterative nature of problem solving. This goes to the very core of the IBM Center, linking theory to practice as a way of shaping the business of government. First up, conversation with leaders. Featuring dedicated public servants from a variety of disciplines who share their extended reflections on the work they do and the service they perform. From enhancing economic opportunities for agricultural producers, to protecting the nation's food supply, to improving nutrition and health, the U.S. Department of Agriculture supports programs that touch the lives of all Americans every day. Here's its Deputy Secretary, Kathleen Merrigan.
It was created in 1862 by an act of Congress and signed into law by Abraham Lincoln, the president, and we refer to it as the People's Department. It's a wonderful place. It's a very big place. We have three big buildings right there on the Smithsonian Mall, but we also have offices around the country and around the world.
USDA is a big place with an expansive mission. Merrigan elaborates.
Well, the budget is about $145 billion. What people don't realize is that nearly two-thirds of that budget is for nutrition assistance programs. So people think USDA, they think farmers, ranchers, but actually we do food stamps, which is a supplemental nutrition assistance program. We are involved in the school meals programs, the National School Lunch Program, for example. So really, the bulk of our money is going to nutrition assistance. We are somewhere in the range of 114,000 FTEs. We are the fifth largest employer in the federal government.
Dr. Merrigan explains her role within the department and the challenges she faces.
As deputies are, they are alter egos to their secretaries. So I am there to advise, first and foremost, Secretary Vilsack on everything that comes before the department. Specifically, I am in charge of the budget process, budget formulation, tracking where the money goes, which is increasingly taking up time in this environment. I have a particular role in this administration to lead efforts on building local and regional food systems. Because of my background coming in, my interest, Secretary Vilsack asked me to lead an initiative. Coming in as a political appointee, I'm very cognizant of the sand running through the hourglass. That is a challenge not only for me, but all senior executives with all the things that are pressing upon us. How do we really have laser focus and know how to manage our time to those priorities? I think it's a really challenging institution to manage USDA because of the breadth of what it does. And the challenge of the disconnect of what Americans know about American agriculture, because less than 1% of Americans now have experience, direct experience, being on the farm or the ranch. They don't really understand the broad mission of USDA. So we really have a sales job that we have to do both to the American people and to other policymakers here inside the Beltway.
So how is USDA connecting people to its varied mission while also promoting the country's agriculture? Here's Deputy Secretary Kathleen Merrigan.
Rural America has been in an economic freefall long before the rest of the economy. And when we came into this administration, Secretary Vilsack, a former two-term governor of Iowa, was very cognizant of the problems in rural America, the infrastructure needs, the lower incomes, the difficulty to access health care. We came into this administration saying we can't do everything. We have to have some strategies. One strategy is broadband access. If people had more broadband access in rural America, that would help with telemedicine, it would help with rural schools, and it certainly would help with entrepreneurialism. Small businesses of all kinds could be created. We're very focused on local and regional food systems as a way of creating job opportunities in rural America. There is a fervor in this country around local and regional foods that creates an opportunity. If we can help build some of that infrastructure that the smaller scale farmers could use to deliver local foods, that's a strategy that we're really high on. There's a lot of emphasis in this administration on green jobs, renewable energy specifically. And we're also very excited about recreation opportunities in our national forests and parklands. Finally, we're really high on ecosystem markets. We need to come up with ecosystem markets where farmers and ranchers and others get a benefit from using their resources in a way that helps overall ecosystem development. So when we talk about the Farm Safety Net at USDA, we have to be talking about more than disaster assistance programs. It's more than just that farm product. At the end of the day, it's about the vitality in those rural communities and whether people are going to run or raise a family there.
In the end, it's about cultivating the vitality of every community, from rural to urban. In an era of fiscal constraint marked by shrinking budgets and an increasing demand on government services, government executives are confronted with very difficult choices. This situation is ever more acute in the delivery of human services to those most in need. Linda Gibbs, Deputy Mayor of Health and Human Services for the City of New York, spoke to us about how the city effectively delivers health and human services and the breadth of her HHS portfolio.
It's pretty big. So it's about $20 billion of services provided by 9 different agencies. It runs from things that affect everybody in the city. Broadly, I think of it as the helping services for the city. We have a set of safety net services that can help people when a crisis arises and can structure our services in a way that can leave them sort of stronger and better off after that intervention happens.
Creating a more holistic approach to human service delivery can be quite challenging, as Linda Gibbs, Deputy Mayor of HHS for New York City, outlines.
You can't ever take your eye off the ball, is you constantly got to be problem spotting, right? Sort of the added value and the obligation is to help anticipate problems before they happen, head them off at the pass so that you don't have a crisis, right?
Anticipating problems and finding ways to solve them is key, especially in an era of fiscal constraint.
We lost our state and federal funding as a result of some state budget cuts, and we're left with the question of what are we going to do in order to deal with this crisis that's going to happen. From my point of view, the best way to do that kind of sort of thinking and problem spotting is you got to like create safe places for the experts who do the work and who know the dynamics to talk and to say what they think might happen and to let them, and so it's got to be sort of no bad ideas in this room, right? So it's like by having a healthy conversation, you can usually identify the problems and at least have strategies for getting to them. That is the worst when you have a crisis that was an avoidable crisis.
New York City relies heavily on the nonprofit sector to deliver social services. It has a special relationship with this sector and has worked with nonprofits to navigate the recession. New York City Deputy Mayor Gibbs elaborates.
It's true that the social service nonprofit organizations are really critical in delivering frontline services. But in New York City, we are probably even more deeply dependent to thousands of nonprofit organizations that are the real folks that are delivering the services. We've had an extraordinarily productive and I think exciting set of initiatives that we've been rolling out in the city that are focused on nonprofit management and nonprofit improvement. And so it falls into a couple of categories. One is really focusing on how to help nonprofits be strong and resilient, an initiative we call Greater New York. And the focus of this initiative is really to improve the strength of nonprofit leadership and management, and to do that with technical assistance and a strong partnership with a successful business sector partner. Another really critical part is just helping nonprofits understand whether, you know, are they the good, the bad, or the ugly? We've developed a whole, again, through the use of technology, developing a set of indicators for nonprofits around their health, fiscal health, staffing, organizational, client service outcome health. The great thing about this is that it is actually connected to an initiative we have to streamline procurement in the cities.
The medical mission of the U.S. Department of Defense is to enhance DoD and the country's security by providing health support for a full range of military operations. It does this through its military health system. Dr. Jonathan Woodson, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, explains.
The military health system is a worldwide enterprise. This year, we're looking at a budget of about $52.5 billion. And the military health system is made up of a large number of components. So we are obviously responsible for combat casualty care, but we're also responsible for what we call garrison care, which is a routine care anybody would receive, similar to that of a civilian sector with hospitals and clinics, primary care clinics.
Doing this requires significant resources and a focused and strategic leader. Here's Dr. Woodson.
We have about 140,000 folks who work within the MHS, but we have a network of over 350 to 380,000 practitioners who provide care to our people through the integrated networks that are established. So it's hospitals, it's clinics, it's combat casualty care, it's research, it's academics, it's a full-service health enterprise. As the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, I am the principal advisor to the Secretary of Defense on all matters related to military health. We're responsible for not only setting policy as it relates to issues in the military health system, but we're responsible for managing the Defense Health Program, which is that $52.5 billion pot of money that needs to be divided up to allow the services to execute the military mission. We, in concert with the services, set the priorities for the military health system, but the services really execute on that mission. So they train, man, and equip the force, and they actually deliver the care within the direct system. And then, of course, we have that insurance program called TRICARE, which provides an integrated set of networks with the civilian partners to deliver care to all of our retirees and beneficiaries and members of the service who may not be clustered around a base where you might have a military treatment facility.
To meet its ultimate mission, the military health system has adopted a strategic construct, the quadruple aim. Dr. Woodson elaborates.
The quadruple aim refers to our strategic goals of improving the patient care experience, improving population health, managing costs, that is being good steward of the public funds that they give to us to deliver care. And all of that is wrapped around our core mission of readiness. So what is so unique about the military health system, of course, is that we've got to be prepared to deploy and engage and support the troops deployed in harm's way in any part of the world at any moment. So anywhere, anytime, we've got to be ready to go. But what is so nice about the quadruple aim is not only does it give us a strategic focus, as it allows everyone within the system to understand where they need to focus their energies and their efforts and where we need to go.
Dr. Jonathan Woodson, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, also offers some important advice for those considering a career in public service.
Bring your intellect, bring your passion, Don't be dissuaded by, again, challenges, because it's when you meet those challenges that you learn the most about yourself and you grow the most. Be ready to operate in that gray zone. That's where all the fun is. Okay? If you knew and could predict the outcome of your efforts, that would be no fun at all. But it's about taking on these challenges and then creating enduring systems that benefit society far into the future.
Next up are Profiles in Leadership, when the special edition of the Business of Government magazine returns. What are the 7 management imperatives all government executives need to know? How is DoD improving its business operations? What is FAA's next generation air transportation system, or NextJet? How is New York City shaping a government that is customer focused, innovative, and more efficient? And what about power, security, and leadership in the 21st century? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. Over the last 6 months, I've had the pleasure of interviewing a variety of government executives who manifest the leadership and commitment needed to meet their varied missions. Each joined us for an hour discussing critical issues facing their agencies. In this edition, we introduce you to 4 leaders who are changing the way government does business. They are indeed profiles in leadership, and here's a glimpse. Dr. Paul Anastas, Assistant Administrator of the Office of Research and Development at EPA, discusses overseeing a wide range of research programs, from basic studies on the toxicity of chemicals to technology development for purifying water.
Well, the Office of Research and Development, which we often call ORD for short, was actually started 40 years ago, back at the beginning of the EPA. And it was a recognition that everything that we do at the EPA needs to be science-based. And so we started out with a core group of scientists, a few of which are still with us today. It has since grown to close to 2,000 federal employees with labs all across the country. So we're looking at how we get the right scientific foundation for all of the decisions and the actions of the EPA.
For Anastas, challenges can really be opportunities. The key question is how you define and approach them.
What the question is how do we use that deep knowledge? How do we use that deep understanding of the problems in order to inform and empower the solutions? So it's one thing to say things are, you know, this bad, or, you know, we need to do things X percent better. It's another thing to say these are some of the approaches that can be taken in order to address not only our air, water, land issues, but how we do them synergistically so that we meet environmental and economic goals simultaneously for societal benefit.
Since taking the reins, Dr. Anastas has set a path forward, providing the scientific and technological basis for advancing EPA's mission. Integration is essential to his strategic vision. It is also fundamental to his effort to incorporate the principle of sustainability into EPA decision-making.
There's a question that we want to ask ourselves, that can we become even more effective by ensuring that these are mutually reinforcing? Are we getting the synergisms that we could be getting if we looked at things from a more systematic and systems approach? And that's really at the heart of sustainability, that very seldom do the environmental challenges that we're looking at divide themselves neatly into an air project or a water project. And so we are stepping back and have reoriented and realigned the entirety of the research portfolio, so that taking this systems approach in order to understand our the questions that we're addressing and the way we define our problems in terms of sustainable systems. Because we went to the National Academy of Sciences last year to ask almost that exact question. How do we make sustainability operational at the EPA? And they've recently come out with a report called EPA and Sustainability, and it's sometimes referred to as the Green Book. And it lays a framework out of what are the analytical tools that either are available today or need to be developed in order to address our questions systematically.
In the end, Dr. Anastas recognizes that none of this happens without a fully engaged, qualified, and professional workforce.
I have been known to repeatedly refer to the mission of the agency of protecting human health and the environment as our sacred mission. And the one good thing is that I'd say everybody at EPA gets that. Everybody at, in the Office of Research and Development gets that. So the motivation comes from that mission. And so it's the clarity of showing how the work that they're doing relates directly to accomplishing that mission. The more that connection is made crystalline and clear, the motivation stems directly from that.
From collecting revenue to disbursing payments, the mission of the U.S. Department of Treasury's Financial Management Service is as varied as it is important. As the federal government's financial manager, FMS touches millions of Americans and virtually every federal agency every day. Dave Liebreck, its commissioner, explains.
We do four things. We make payments for most of the federal agencies. We collect the monies that fund the operations of government. We report on the financial activity of the government, and we do debt collection. This is something that we feel quite passionate about. But when you're making lifeline payments to people every month, you know, Social Security payments and benefit payments to people who really need the funds, you realize that you're doing something very important and very significant. When you're collecting the money to fund government operations and you're doing that effectively, that's awfully important. And when you're reporting on the financial activity of the government, decision makers have the ability to really understand better the impact of their decisions if they have good data. And then finally, as it relates to debt collection, we feel quite keenly about that in the sense that half of the collections that we do are for delinquent child support. So when you talk to the people within FMS, while it may sound like standard back office kinds of things, when you look at the actual mission of what we do, there's a lot of passion around it and a lot of sense that there's purpose and meaning to what we do.
FMS faces many challenges. Commissioner Liebreck identifies budget, leading in a time of change, and agency collaboration. But he's also pursuing five priorities to meet these challenges head on.
I think that probably we, as most of everyone in government right now, will have the new budget environment is a challenge. We at FMS operate with sort of five overarching priorities, and those overarching priorities are daily operations, doing that well. The second is moving from paper to electronics and everything that we can do. The third is cost management. As it relates to the budget, one of the things I think FMS has done well over the years is really focused on driving costs out. But it's really looking at those core business functions and saying, how do we do a better job of doing what we do more efficiently and effectively? So while I think that that number is a pretty significant number, those are, in terms of our budget getting smaller, those are issues that we brought to the table. Those were not really being forced by budget pressures. They were us looking at our business and figuring out how do we really become more efficient in what we do.
FMS has expanded its use of analytics. Here's Commissioner Liebreck.
The debt area is the one that's the most natural, but we also know in the payments area and the collections area that we can use these same analytical tools. Now, let me give an example. In the payments area, if we were taking a harder look at whether there was a repeat payment being made to the same address for the same amount, one might cue that up and say, I wonder if that's an improper payment. And so these analytical tools have the ability to sort of pull it out and highlight it and say, well, maybe we should take a closer look at that, whether that's the right payment. In the collections area, if there's unusual activity in collections, some behavior, the analytical tools can help you sort of look at that and say, well, maybe we should flag that. So I think this has a lot of promise in the improper payments area, for example. I think that ultimately how you want to use your technology and your business intelligence tools is to date, we really use our reporting systems to report on how things are and to look backwards. But what you really want to do ultimately is to have that technology allow you and that business intelligence to allow you to be predictive and looking forward. And so if you're going to get the highest value and highest use out of your technology and your business intelligence, you want to use it for forecasting and predictive purposes along the way. And so I think for where FMS sits, we sit on an enormous amount of data. And the ability for us to use that data to do predictive analysis is a really promising area for the organization going forward.
Commissioner Liebreck understands that the success of many FMS initiatives rests on improving performance, implementing better processes, enhancing operations, and achieving outcomes. Doing this effectively and efficiently involves having the right people with the right skills in the right position.
You know, we take stewardship at FMS and our responsibilities to the taxpayer very seriously, and that permeates everything that we do. When we look at, you know, when we're serving the public, when we look at whether we're giving the public good value, we feel very keenly about that and adding value and doing something that's meaningful.
The U.S. Maritime Administration has a varied and vital mission: advancing the economic competitiveness of the United States while also supporting a viable, safe, and secure U.S. maritime transportation system. David Matsuda, its administrator, promotes the vital role of this industry.
Unlike many of our agency partners, we don't regulate. We're more of a promotional agency. So while the department's chief mission is safety, we do maintain a strong promotional advocacy role for the maritime industry.
Matsuda explains how he meets this important mission and leads his agency.
We've got about 830 employees, a budget of about $300 to $400 million of appropriated funds, but frankly, we do a lot of services for other federal agencies and manage about $1 billion total. We've got a headquarters office here at the Department of Transportation headquarters, about 250 employees. The Merchant Marine Academy, which we oversee, about 250 employees up there in Kings Point, New York, out on Long Island. And the remainder of the field offices are spread throughout the continental U.S. As administrator, the buck stops with me, and I'm responsible for the functioning of the agency, the overall operation, and as the chief advisor to the Secretary of Transportation on maritime issues and activities, I take that role very seriously. As I mentioned earlier, we have a unique role in that we're primarily an advocacy or promotional agency. So we don't do, you know, the type of safety regulation and oversight that the other agencies do in the department. But I know the Department of Transportation has a strong initiative and is one of their strategic goals to promote the economic competitiveness of the United States. And that is something that is our primary role as well when we deal with the United States maritime industry. We want to promote it. We want to promote jobs, U.S. businesses, economic opportunities for both the workers and businesses in this key industry.
The U.S. Maritime Administration faces many challenges. For its administrator, David Matsuda, it's really about facing the demons of the past.
Probably the top challenge has been trying to deal with the demons of the past for this agency and refocusing on the challenges of the future, the things we really need to be looking at. I'll say that one of the first things I dealt with when I first came to the agency was an ongoing and contentious lawsuit with a local community in the San Francisco Bay Area. We spent a lot of time and effort settling the lawsuit, and it's been a very successful settlement. The other one that we've dealt with is the United States Merchant Marine Academy at Kings Point. We have taken a very strong and intense effort to make sure that the financial control and internal controls are in place to be able to give Congress and others the credibility and confidence that we can handle funds appropriately. And in fact, the school so badly needs them. So it really was a top priority. And again, fixing some of these problems of the past has allowed us to really focus on challenges going forward.
The success of many of these initiatives involves cultivating the next generation of merchant mariners. Matsuda takes seriously his agency's mandate to cultivate this next generation. He points out that his boss, Secretary Ray LaHood, has made it a department priority for the United States Merchant Marine Academy in Kings Point, New York, to be a jewel among the federal service academies.
The key role and mission is to graduate future maritime leaders for the industry. Its focus is working to develop not just mariner skills, not just engineering skills, the academic, but they want to, like the other academies, are focusing on developing the complete person. A strong focus, again, not just on academics, not just on ship handling, but on leadership. And we've seen over time that, you know, these are folks, many of them go on to be leaders in the industry. They work their way up, you know, after sailing for some time and taking that experience and really leveraging it and going on to do great things.
The future of this country's maritime industry may depend on such a commitment. Once again, Administrator Matsuda.
The one good thing about the maritime industry is I found people are so mission-focused and dedicated that we often don't have much of a problem finding good people to work at the maritime administration. The challenge is keeping them and growing the next generation as well.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security has an expansive mission, and managing its resources efficiently and effectively as one DHS is key to its successfully meeting that mission. Dr. Nick Nyack, DHS Chief Procurement Officer, offers his insight into the procurement strategies of his department.
Specifically, the mission, as all of us know, is to ensure that the homeland is safe, secure, and resilient against terrorism and other hazards. Specifically, within the Chief Procurement Officer office, as well as the component acquisition personnel around the department, we spend nearly $20 billion a year, and that's 46% of the DHS discretionary budget. Our current focus is on sort of three phases in acquisition: requirements, definition, the procurement process itself, and then finally managing programs. In this sort of rough order of magnitude, $55 billion with a discretionary budget of $42 billion. So of the $42 billion, we buy people and we establish contracts. People, we have about 230,000 employees, seven operational components under the DHS headquarters structure, and people are all over the United States, and we have a footprint internationally as well.
Dr. Nayak explains the resources that go into meeting DHS's procurement needs and the many challenges he faces.
Under me, there are 1,400 contracting professionals spending nearly $20 billion a year. We have roughly 18,000 long-term contracts and 98,000 contract actions that are performed by these 1,400 contracting personnel. My procurement workforce provides support for 500 programs that directly impact the DHS mission. I kind of look at them as four broad areas of challenge that we have. One is people, two is contracting, three is program support, and the last one is industry government communication, which is a priority that I've established that I want to institutionalize within the department. Specifically in people, we need to have the right people. The business that we do, acquisition, all of the contracting actions, 98,000, gets done by people. We have to have quality people, so that is my first priority. My second priority is contracting. There's a ton of things we have to do in contracting, very specifically fiscal austerity, which means I've got to find ways to enhance competition, reduce high-risk contracts, and basically get a good deal for the government. The third one is program support. So we're not in the business of just awarding contracts. We award contracts to support programs that then meet the mission of the agency. So what are we doing in the contracting community to enhance program support? And there's a number of things that we're doing there. And then the last one is we want to engage industry at the appropriate points in the acquisition process so that ultimately, again, we get a better deal.
NIAC recognizes the need to effectively engage industry.
If half of the discretionary budget is spent on connecting with industry and contracting with industry, that is, it's just essential that we have effective engagement. But I want everybody to know that this is going to be a priority. It will be institutionalized, and they can look forward to incremental progress over the years to come.
Communicating with industry prior to and throughout the procurement process can enable the department to leverage existing technologies, expertise, and experience to accomplish a shared goal. Nick Nayak elaborates.
You have to pay attention to change and plan for that. You need to treat people, your employees, extremely well. You need to take care of your customers. And ultimately, you need to drive business results. In my world, that means I've got to be able to demonstrate we're getting a good deal for the government.
Next up, perspectives on changing the way the U.S. Department of Defense does business when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour returns. What is FAA's Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen? How is the U.S. Department of Homeland Security turning its one DHS vision into reality? What is New York City doing to shape a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And how is the DoD improving its business operations? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Hear from FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, DHS Undersecretary for Management Raphael Boris, New York City Deputy Mayor for Operations Stephen Goldsmith, and Dave Winogrand, Assistant Deputy Chief Management Officer at DOD. Professor Joseph Nye and General Anthony Zinni on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century, and seven management imperatives that government leaders should pursue to be successful in an era of fiscal constraint. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. The U.S. Department of Defense is one of the largest and most complex organizations in the world, managing a budget more than twice that of the world's largest corporation and overseeing millions of personnel operating worldwide. Given the size and complexity, of the department's finances and operations, along with the rapid pace of change, engagement in major military campaigns, and worldwide economic uncertainty, it is imperative that the DoD create an agile, responsive, and efficient operation. In this segment, we present the perspectives of two key DoD leaders directly involved in changing the way the U.S. Department of Defense does its business, both bringing an exacting combination of practical knowledge and an understanding of the work to be done and the progress already achieved. First up, Bob Hale, Undersecretary of Defense and Comptroller, on the complexity of managing the U.S. Department of Defense.
I'll go with the facts first. This year, we will execute about $688 billion worth of budget authority of the taxpayers' money to maintain our national security. So we obligate $2 to $3 billion a day on average. It's a very sizable amount. In terms of the specific things that I do, as I mentioned, we spend a lot of time formulating budgets. It's our way of putting together our priorities. Also need to put them together in a way that can convince the Congress and the public that we both need the resources and will spend them appropriately to maintain national security. And then we have a responsibility to make sure that we execute those budgets in a manner that's legal. And there are 8,000 pages in the DoD Financial Management Regulations, so there are lots of laws and regulations. It's effective, that we meet the needs of our warfighters. And finally, it's efficient, for the sake of the taxpayers, and maybe particularly in these days, efficiency is very much on our minds.
As achieving efficiencies is very much on the mind of Undersecretary Hale, so are many of the challenges he faces managing the resources of the DoD.
Well, certainly a key challenge is to make sure that we acquire the resources that we need to meet national security objectives and do that when we're dealing with a nation that is in an economic crisis. Secretary Panetta has said that we understand we need to be part of efforts to hold down the deficit. At the same time, it's a dangerous world. We're still in a shooting war in Afghanistan. We're completing the military mission in Iraq. I think a key challenge is striking that right balance, getting the resources we need, but understanding that we need to make every dollar count in order to hold down the deficit. Once we get the resources, we need to execute them, as I've said, in a manner that's effective. I think we do that pretty well. A bigger challenge, though, is how well we do at documenting how we've spent the money and presenting that information to the public. And in particular, we are one of the two federal agencies that has never had a clean opinion, accounting opinion on, or audit opinion on its financial statements. And that's something we need to change. The last one I'll mention is championing, working for a strong financial management workforce. We need to have those 68,000 people well-trained, and I think they generally are. So I'd say that the budget job, certainly a major challenge, auditability, a major challenge, working to maintain a strong workforce, also a challenge.
Auditability is a major challenge for DoD. Undersecretary Hale outlines DoD's financial improvement and audit readiness strategy.
Let me start by saying I believe the Department of Defense has reasonable controls over its budgets. There are some of our critics who assert the contrary. I think they're wrong. As evidence of that, I just note quickly that we have 3,000 auditors who are watching our program and financial moves, and yet we have quite high levels of compliance with key financial legislation, quite high levels of proper payments. But we do need to achieve auditable financial statements for a variety of reasons. They'll help us clean up some imperfections that we may talk about more in our business processes, but most importantly, they'll reassure the public that we're reasonable stewards of their money. And in terms, when I came into this job, there had been progress made, no question. But I think I quickly realized the department wasn't heading in a single direction. Services were doing different things. Some were doing more, some less. No common purpose. We were sometimes trying to do things where there wasn't much management commitment to doing it. So we formulated, I call it the focused approach. It basically pretty simple. It says, let's put our highest priorities on improving information and achieving audit readiness for the kinds of information we most use to manage the Pentagon. And that's first and foremost budgetary information, because we manage the department based on budgets. And second, where our assets are and how many we have, which is very important to warfighters. Auditors call it existence and completeness. So we have focused our attention on trying to improve information in for those categories and move toward audit readiness.
Given DoD's scale of operation, Bob Hale highlights some of the major challenges and obstacles facing the department in its efforts to improve financial information and audit readiness.
You've stated one of them in the question, which is our size and our geographical dispersion. What they mean is that we can't go hire an army of accountants, or it would be such a large army that we could never afford it, and do all this work manually. And that brings me to two other major challenges or impediments, if you will, that we face. First, our systems, our financial systems, many of them are old. Some of them date back to the 70s and 80s, and they aren't designed to do what auditors expect. They're designed to keep track of budgets. They're not designed to accommodate audits. When an auditor pulls a sample of thousands of payments spread all around the world, we have to go chase down the paper, and it's a task that you can't do quickly, and it's very expensive. The new systems that we're putting in will keep this information in an automated fashion, so it works well. We'll push a button, and when an auditor asks for it, it will be there. So we need new financial systems. The other thing we need are to improve our business processes. Well, I think we have reasonable controls. Our business processes are variable across our commands, sometimes from base to base. They may be effective, but in some cases, they're simply not something an auditor would accept. The auditors want to see more detail where we put it, and so we're going to have to change that business practice in order to move toward auditability. So there are some major challenges that we've got to overcome. We're on our way, but it's going to be a lengthy journey.
Though the road to achieving auditability at DoD is lengthy and arduous, Undersecretary Hale points to some of the key successes to date.
Well, we have made some progress. The Army Corps of Engineers, which is actually not part of the DoD budget but still affiliated with the military, has fully auditable financial statements and is maintaining them, has for several years. Several of our large defense agencies have had auditable statements for sometimes more than a decade and have maintained them, the Defense Finance and Accounting Service, Defense Contract Audit Agency, Defense Commissary Agency, and some others. And some of our trust funds, we maintain some very large trust funds for military retirement and military health care, also have a positive audit opinions. What we haven't done yet is achieve that goal for any of the military services, and that is by far the highest hurdle to leap. They are much more complex. They're bigger than anything we have gone after yet. But we have, for the first time ever, a statement of a military service, in this case the United States Marine Corps, under audit their statement of budgetary resources, and I'm cautiously optimistic that we'll see a positive opinion this year, more optimistic that we'll make it by next year. So we're moving into what I might call the big boy issues of auditability in terms of actually working on the military services, and we just have to go after them before we're ever going to get close.
Working closely with Undersecretary Hale to achieve meaningful improvements within DoD is Beth McGrath, its Deputy Chief Management Officer. Beth highlights her role and the role of her fairly young office in changing the way DoD does its business.
So in 2005, we established the Business Management Modernization Program to look more holistically across the business enterprise and not just focus on the financials. And there, too, Congress recognized that we needed some more tools in our toolbox, if you will, to really go after the entire business space. So it is around that time that Congress legislated to us the utilization of a business enterprise architecture, enterprise transition plan, more effective governance, really the tools that most corporations have as they manage their overall operation. The Deputy Chief Management Officer position was established in the 2009 National Defense Authorization Act. And it was there that they created both the position of the Deputy Chief Management Officer and codified the role of the Deputy Secretary of Defense as the Chief Management Officer or Chief Operating Officer across the department. And that really elevated the conversation to be more holistic, not only within the OSD element, but also across the military departments. Because in that same legislation, they identified the undersecretaries of the military departments as the chief management officers for their respective components. So they really put the structure across the department, across all of the business lines, to effectively manage and oversee and integrate the entire business space.
Beth McGrath faces many challenges in her efforts to transform the business processes and operations of the U.S. Department of Defense.
I would say size creates a challenge because to try and implement something across an enterprise that is as big as the 16th country in the world would be, that doesn't happen overnight, nor does it happen very easily. And so really it's coming up with a framework that can be executed, replicated, and implemented across the defense enterprise is absolutely probably my top two challenges if I was to was able to account the size for the first two. But I would also add complexity. complexity to that list. Many of our operations have started, and when I say operations, I don't mean from a military perspective. The way we conduct business is very, very different. We are very non-standard. Frankly, by design, we were that way. So if you put size and complexity together, one would wonder why I would want this job. But I do think it's terribly exciting because it's also an opportunity to really make significant change in an enterprise that, you know, really wants to and can execute in just the most tremendous ways. Building this coalition for change across the department, articulating the importance of the business mission and how it really facilitates and empowers and enables our core national security mission, I think, is a tremendous opportunity. And so, you know, size and complexity, yes, we have both, but we also have some of the best, you know, people that, you know, I certainly have had the opportunity to work with. And it's really getting to those people to enable the change and establish the change agents across the whole Federation, if you will, is really the a very exciting part of what I do.
In meeting many of these challenges head-on, McGrath outlines the department's strategy for improving its critical business operations.
The business enterprise architecture, and the way I characterize the architecture is that I've talked a little bit about the holistic approach and this end-to-end focus that we have in the department. The architecture is the place you write it down. So if you made agreement on a business process or a standard in a specific area, you need a place to write it down that everybody knows, you know, it's going to be there. And so that is the blueprint, if you will, that drives the path ahead from a business perspective. So I mentioned that the BEA needs to align to a strategy for it to be purposeful and meaningful. The strategic management plan is the business strategic document. It's also aligned to the department's overarching strategic document, which is the Quadrennial Defense Review. And there's an overarching goal in the QDR that talks about, you know, implementing the reform agenda and really going after the business space. And that's where we hook, if you will, the SMP, the Strategic Management Plan, to the overarching enterprise goals. The Enterprise Transition Plan is the document that says, well, here's where I am today and here's how I'm getting to the future state. And so that really is the document that says, here's where I am today and this is the place I want to be, and then how we're going to get there and by when.
Focusing on DoD's core business missions is critical to changing the way it does business. Beth McGrath elaborates.
So the core business areas that we had previously defined, weapon systems, life cycle management, material supply and services, real property and infrastructure, financial management, and human resources. Those areas are very much aligned to the way DoD is organized. And we have really found that in order to drive business improvements or business operations, you really need to cut across the various functional areas. Those are all very functionally aligned, tied to an organization. And so we're really looking at, you know, what are the end-to-end processes that we really need to go after? There are 15 that are in the commercial space, and we have chosen two of them to put our main focus on, and they are hire to retire and procure to pay. And it's really taking a look at defining what the high-level end-to-end process looks like. What standards do you need? What changes do you need to make? And what systems do you have that are currently executing those processes? You'd be amazed what you find when you start mapping sort of systems to process. And then, you know, it is no secret that DoD has thousands of systems that are not interoperable. And so the goal here is to say, well, if I'm trying to execute an end-to-end process, which is what we do every day, then our system should be enablers to the execution of that process. And so it's, I'm going to say, not terribly exciting to some people to, you know, map systems to processes. But when you see really the opportunity to make things better and more seamless, it's really hard not to do something about it. And so really we are mapping and aligning and documenting the various processes and standards, because those are the things that make things go. I mean, we want it to be invisible to the operators out there. They don't need to know all about the procure to pay and hire to retire. At the end of the day, they just want their paycheck right, and they want it fast. They want the information reliable and accurate so that they can make decisions about, you know, do I have enough cash to buy this or do I need to do something else? I mean, it's all about achieving business outcomes.
For McGrath, it's all about achieving business outcomes. Getting off the GAO high-risk list exemplifies her outcome-based approach.
So we spend a lot of time with our partners in the Government Accountability Office. DOD owns on its own 8 of the 30 and then shares another 7, which is how we get to we own half. In the personal security clearance area, again, it was very much focused not only on the DOD backlog and transaction time, it was focused on the federal space because there were issues across the federal government about the backlog and then the time it took to actually get a security clearance. And so it was really a partnership with the Office of Personnel Management, who is the main investigative service provider for the federal government, the Office of Management and Budget, and the management side, the Deputy Director for Management and the Office of the Director for National Intelligence, the DNI. And it really took everyone to do their piece, both the policy, process, and information technology to enable us to get off the high-risk list. And so Lean Six Sigma, that is where we started. We essentially locked everyone in a room and said, we need to re-look at the process. And we did discover that there were changes that ought to be made in the federal investigative standards. And we had the people at the table, being the Office of Personnel Management and the Director of National Intelligence, because they own security policy from a federal perspective. So they are the policy owners, if you will. You know, step up and make changes to those federal investigative standards. And then we looked at the backlog, really put a lot of people on it in addition to IT, and we're able to take 100,000 case backlog for DOD down to zero. So that, to me, is a significant improvement. Also, our average security clearance time back then was 165 days. That was in 2006. And today it's roughly about 47 days. And so, I mean, that's tremendous.
As their perspectives indicate, Hale and McGrath have spearheaded a promising partnership between the CFO and DCMO communities within the U.S. Department of Defense. They are collaborators as well as leaders in making the Secretary's vision a reality. In the end, it is clear that their collective focus is on enhancing the department by making it more efficient, accountable, and strategic in the use of mission support resources, with the ultimate aim, providing the best possible support to the warfighter. Stay tuned as we wrap up this edition of the Business of Government magazine. Each edition of the Business of Government magazine has as its focus the core mission of the IBM Center, connecting research to practice as a means to improve public management. We do this by bringing together insights and perspectives blended with an equal measure of practicality and reflection from an array of government leaders, public managers, thinkers, and practitioners. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. In an era of fiscal contraction, today's leaders face unique challenges that present many difficult choices. It is a period that, while imposing many constraints, simultaneously confers as many opportunities to make a difference, introduce new ways of managing, explore pragmatic approaches, and pursue management imperatives that help government leaders perform in an ever-challenging, complex environment. In our latest edition, we bring you conversations with FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, outlining the Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen. Rafael Boris, DHS Undersecretary for Management, discusses how the department is turning its one DHS vision into a reality. Stephen Goldsmith, Deputy Mayor for Operations for the City of New York, discusses how the city is shaping a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and efficient. We offer perspectives on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century from Professor Joseph S. Nye Jr. and General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command. Our forum presents 7 management imperatives that government leaders must pursue to be successful in this new environment. All of this and so much more in the Spring-Summer 2011 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. In this edition of Insights, we introduce you to Colonel Donald Dellinger, Deployment Director of the National Guard Joint Continuous Process Improvement Initiative, on shaping the future of the National Guard Bureau.
The mission of the National Guard Bureau is to participate with the Army and Air Force staffs in programs pertaining to the National Guard. And we also work with the states and the adjutants generals with the 54 states and territories to assist in maintaining and developing the National Guard for the future missions and roles that we give into the Guard. The Joint CPI Office was established in 2009 by General McKinley, and the purpose was to assist in maintaining mission and ready forces by removing waste and non-value activities. The mission of the National Guard Bureau Joint Process Improvement Office is to create a culture of continuous improvement by deploying tools, training, and mentoring soldiers and airmen throughout the National Guard. And in my duties and responsibilities, the main one is just overseeing the entire program from cradle to grave. So basically, we take from change management to training to mentoring and coaching to project completion. So the whole gamut and all the mechanics of having a successful continuous process improvement deployment within an organization.
Colonel Dellinger identifies some of the key challenges he faces in his role and what he's done to overcome them.
I would probably say the top issue that we're challenged, that we're facing right now, is influencing culture change at the top. The real culture change comes from people in senior leadership positions who are kind of set and used to the way of doing business and don't necessarily gravitate to new ways of doing things, especially when they're focused on the mission right at hand and they looking at the investment and not really knowing how well it's going to work. And so to address that, my main job as the deployment director, the CPI director, is to go have those senior leader engagements and educate the senior leadership on what continuous process improvement is about and how Lean Six Sigma can help them achieve their goals and objectives that's nested within their strategy. The second one is how to sustain the effort. So the chief of the National Guard Bureau does not have direct command and control over those individuals or those states or organizations to be able to direct them to implement continuous process improvement. He can only recommend and provide resources for them to execute if they so see that it would assist them. And so sustaining the effort is very difficult because you have change in leadership. And so ensuring that you have a viable training pipeline, a sustaining new leaders coming in so that when the old leaders move out, that you have provided a lifeline, so to speak, of the growth and the continued use of Lean Six Sigma and that thought process throughout. The other piece that we have is my office is just kind of an advisory role. There's no direct command and control over the execution of the program. So although we know best practices and the things that would help facilitate a successful continuous process improvement deployment, we can only advise since we do not execute. And so trying to overcome those obstacles takes a lot of personal meetings and relationship building to overcome that.
Dellinger understands that the success of his efforts is not an end in itself. Rather, it's an opportunity to start something new.
Well, I think change management is the real key to what we're talking about here. The methodology is sound. The real question is, how do you get leaders to buy into the methodology to be able to execute it the way it needs to be executed to receive those benefits? I think it's a continuous dialogue, continuous education, having a really robust strategic communication plans to be able to highlight your success stories and proof of principle. I think once you have that proof of principle, it's hard to deny the results or the potential of what can be achieved. But I think that continuous communication, the continuous beating of the drum of how important it is and how it's going to help the organization, then communicating those successes is very important and are very critical. And so I think adding value is the most important thing and how quickly you do that. And so without that change management aspect, you're looking at a problem-solving methodology that may benefit a little bit of the organization, but it's not going to have the power or really improve the organization to the extent in which it can.
As we close this edition of the Business of Government magazine, I invite you to read our latest forum on leading in the era of complex challenges. History is replete with evidence that complex or so-called wicked problems shun large, expansive solutions. By their very nature, these types of challenges are hard to define. What we can glean from it all is that we need smart approaches that take seriously the context of a problem and the realities of the day. Problems are rarely solved so much as they are alleviated, superseded, or transformed. Our Fall-Winter 2011 forum highlights two recent IBM Center reports that offer lessons on how to tackle complex challenges, as well as the role transformational leadership can play in seizing the opportunities these challenges present to today's government leaders. You may order or download a free copy of the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.
How is the U.S. Government Accountability Office working to put the country on a sustainable fiscal path? What is GAO doing to assist Congress and ensure accountability to the American people? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and much more with his very special guest, Gene Todaro, Comptroller General of the United States and head of the U.S. Government Accountability Office, next week on the Business of Government Hour.